QFTs with defects. And I'll start to present kind of a bit of motivation and the main results first. So let me give a bit of recent developments, how this work, which was quite recent, resulted. And this started with a suggestion some time ago that we made that we can take, in principle, any TQFT and use that to define a representation for loop quantum gravity or a quantum geometry realization, where this TQFT would serve to define a vacuum state. And this idea has been realized in its purest form by a recent work with Marc Gilaire, where we constructed for the 2 plus 1 dimensional case a quantum geometry realization that is a representation for loop quantum gravity observable algebra based on the 2RF0 TQFT. So there the vacuum state was peaked on homogeneously curved geometries, and we have curvature excitations which are described by defects, and that defines you a Hilbert space, and you can define this Hilbert space to be the Hilbert space of a continuum theory. And then there was an immediate and obvious question, which was, this was 2 plus 1, so how to generalize this construction to 3 plus 1 dimension? And the key problem there is that in 2 plus 1, braiding relations, which really need the plane that is a two-dimensional surface, are actually very central for the 2 plus 1 dimensional theory. And so how do you actually put that into 3 plus 1 dimensions? And recently, with Clément Delcambre, we developed a strategy where we said we can actually take a 2 plus 1 dimensional TQFT and lift that to a 3 plus 1 dimensional theory, where this theory would then describe a topological quantum field theory, but with line defects. And this strategy and this result is kind of quite related to also recent work by Behrens and John Barrett. And in fact, this later work constructs non-trivial 4D topological invariants, which is a very nice result. And it's based on Hendel decompositions, and we will see that also our work is related to Hendel decomposition, just one theory, one dimension lower. And so, in fact, we believe that this work provides a canonical formulation of the TQFTs proposed by Behrens and Barrett, and in addition includes the possibility to include line defects. There's also a series of work by Hal Haggard and friends, and basically this current work will provide a canonical quantization of the phase space they described for the simplex, and we not only can treat the simplex, but a general 3D triangulation. So very recently, in January, I applied the strategy to the 2RF0 TQFT and obtained a 3 plus 1 dimensional theory with line defects, and the claim is that this describes a quantum geometry realization where the vacuum is given by the Krein-Jetta theory. So in terms of results, this provides a rigorous implementation of the quantum group structure into 3 plus 1 dimensional LQG. And I say here rigorous because it provides a very nice and rigorous and actually elegant implementation of the braiding relations. And the one feature which I believe has not been there before, which allows this elegant implementation of these braiding relations, is actually that we really use as vacuum state the Krein-Jetta TQFT. So basically, that allows us to deform Wilson loops, basically the connections, because we have a flat vacuum, a flat curvature with respect to the excess curvature. And being allowed to deform the Wilson loops, you can actually now you are able to really project them onto a 2D surface and use the braiding relations. So that's a bit harder if you kind of come from a context where you would try to use Ashtika-Lewandowski vacuum, for instance, because then it's not very clear what it means to deform Wilson loops and try to impose the braiding relations. So the quantum group structure, we use here a quantum group at root of unity, And that means that we use a quantum group which is basically described by a level k. You can imagine that this level k imposes a cutoff on the Laud spins. So we do have a maximal spin and therefore a maximal area. And this comes from the fact that if you have a positively homogeneously curved sphere, for instance, you can have only a maximal area for a triangle on the sphere. And this is basically imposed by the cutoff. So instead of having homogeneously flat building blocks, which can be, of course, arbitrarily large, we will have homogeneously curved building blocks. And that's what is very nicely implemented by using this quantum group at the root of unity. Okay, and you can actually determine K with an argument which relates BF theory with a topological term, with a cosmological constant term to Chern-Simons theory. And that allows to determine K. Now, there's some numerical values involved, but basically what we have to just remember is that K, this level K in four dimensions, is proportional to one over the cosmological constant. Okay, so as I said, this gives a new family of 3+1 dimensional quantum geometry realizations, which are based on a vacuum peaked on homogeneously curved geometry. And that's a Krenyetta topological quantum field theory. And these quantum geometry realizations have some very nice properties. And then one important one is the finiteness property, because the Hilbert spaces, at least the Hilbert space associated to a fixed triangulation, are now really finite dimensional. And you can actually provide this finite, I mean, count the number of states in a given Hilbert space. And that's, of course, important for numerical coarse graining efforts. But it also means physically just that all geometric operators have discrete and bounded spectra, and we can even give this spectra. And here, what I speak of operators which would preserve your triangulation or your graph structure, of course.
Okay, so that, Bianca,
yeah.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Yeah. So in the middle, when you say that a new family of 3+1D quantum mm-hmm. geometry realizations,
mm-hmm.
this is just at the kinematical level, or?
Yeah, so this will be the same on the same kinematical level as we had previously. So this is really 3+1D kinematics.
Okay, thank you.
It provides you with a representation of the observable algebra, of a deformed observable algebra of loop quantum gravity. You know, and these are the kinematical observables. Okay. On the way, we will actually use the 2+1 dimensional theory, and that will be the physical theory. We will come to that. So another nice feature of this quantum realization, which was a bit of a surprise, is a very interesting self-duality. It's actually kind of born reciprocity. So momentum and configuration space are basically the same, and actually both described by SU2. And physically, that means that the spectra of curvature operator and basically exponentiated area operators coincide. As we will see, both operators are actually implemented as Wilson loop operators, but around different cycles. And something basically the same was found in this work by Hal Haggard and friends. And we can diagonalize these operators, and they are diagonalized by a generalized spin network basis and a new curvature basis, respectively. And so here I have given the spectrum for a normalized Wilson loop operator. So that will give the spectrum for this area and for the curvature operator. And normalized means I take the Wilson loop and divide it by the quantum dimension of this Wilson loop, of the Wilson loop representation, which you can take as k. And then the spectrum is labeled, the points in the spectrum are labeled by also a spin, j. And as you see, you are completely symmetric in j and k. And in the limit of large level, you also see that you can extract the usual area spectrum of LQG, which is j plus 1. OK, as I said, you have these two bases which are dual to each other. the spin network basis, which we love and is basically just labeled by these SU2K quantum spins, and it's based on the dual graph. And there's another basis where the labels indicate the curvature, and this is, you know, similarly labeled by SU2K spins, and it's based on the one skeleton of the triangulation. Additionally, there are many other bases you can choose, and you can also choose kind of very non-local bases which are just the two coarse graining schemes. So these are the main features of this quantum geometry I will present. Let me give the main idea of this construction. And that's basically the strategy to take a 2 plus 1 dimensional TQFT and to lift it to a 3 plus 1 dimensional theory with line defects. So here you take a 2 plus 1 dimensional TQFT, which assigns to a surface, more precisely to the non-contractible curves of the surface, degrees of freedom, which we usually interpret as curvature degrees of freedom. So in this picture, you see some non-contractible curves, and we want to usually assign just degrees of freedom to these non-contractible curves, which are, of course, determined by the topology of the surface. So now what we want to do is to assign also degrees of freedom, but now in 3 plus 1, so for a three-dimensional manifold, but to a triangulation of this three-dimensional manifold. And what we want to have is to have non-trivial degrees of freedom, which are assigned to non-contractible curves if you don't allow these curves to contract through the edges of this triangulation. So what we can do is to take our three-dimensional manifold and basically remove the one skeleton of the triangulation. Here in this example, I took a triangulation provided by actually two tetrahedra identified to each other. That means we can take the three sphere and remove the one skeleton of this tetrahedron, or just this one tetrahedron. And what we get is a boundary, which is just looks like a thickening of this tetrahedron. And on the surface, which is defined by this boundary, we have two kinds of curves. We have curves which go on round edges. And indeed, to these curves, we want to assign degrees of freedom. But we have also non-contractible curves which go around the triangles of this tetrahedron. And actually, these curves are contractible in the surrounding three spheres. And we do not want to assign degrees of freedom to these curves. So what we have to do is, what we can do is to take basically the state space of this 2 plus 1 dimensional TQFT, apply it to this surface, basically of the second tetrahedron. But what we have to do in addition is to impose flatness constraints for the curves around the triangles. And that's the basic idea. And I described it for you for one example, but it actually works in general. And this general theory is based on the theory of Hegart splittings and Hegart diagrams. And the theory allows you to encode three-dimensional topology on a surface. And so you can take actually any compact 3D manifold. So mostly in this talk, I will take a three sphere, but you can also take three toes or anything more complicated. And what you have to do is to find a splitting of this three-dimensional manifold into two handle bodies. Luckily, there's a nice way to get the splitting. Namely, you can use the triangulation of the 3D manifold, and you can produce one handle body as a thickening of this one skeleton of the triangulation, and you can produce a second handle body as a thickening of the dual graph to this triangulation. And these two handle bodies, if you glue them together, will just give you back the compact 3D manifold. Now you get the surface just as this intersection of these two handle bodies, and that defines the Hegart surface. So here it would be the surface of the second tetrahedra, of the second one skeleton of the tetrahedra. So the Hegart surface is not sufficient to encode the topology of the 3D manifold. What you have to provide in addition is two sets of curves. One set of curve is supposed to generate you all cycles which are contractible in one handle body. And the other set of curves is supposed to generate all cycles which are contractible in the other handle bodies. So that in your 3D manifold, you would know all contractible. You could differentiate between contractible and non-contractible curves. So in the end, you want to just know what curves are basically non-contractible. And for that reason, so now we can just take all curves on your 2D manifolds and just ignore all curves which are contractible as given by these two sets of curves. So the Hegart diagram is defined as the Hegart surface equipped with these two sets of curves. And that uniquely describes you or encodes you this topology of a 3D manifold.
I'm sorry, but most people, I think, don't know what a Hegart surface is. Can you explain to us what that means?
So the Hegart surface is defined as the intersection of these two handle bodies. The handle body, technically, it's a 3D manifold with boundary, which you can get from basically gluing spheres via connecting them, solid spheres, via connecting them with solid cylinders. So this is actually all what a handle body is. And then it is really, if you have given a decomposition of a compact 3D manifold into these two handle bodies, so you can regain your compact 3D manifold as a disjoint union of these two handle bodies, the Hegart surface is just given as an intersection of these two handle bodies. So it's just the surface of one of these two handle bodies. It's the same surface. Okay?
So if I'm given a decomposition of a compact three manifold with many, yeah, many cells, then, yeah, I would have many, many handle bodies and many, many Hegart surfaces?
No.
How does it?
No. Because if you take a complicated triangulation, you do get two handle bodies, because you get always one handle body as a one skeleton of as a thickening of the one skeleton of the triangulation. So that's one handle body, and then there's a second one which you get from the thickening of the dual graph to the triangulation. So there are just these two handle bodies. What happens is that these two handle bodies, if you take a very complicated triangulation, have a very high genius. So what is indeed not uniquely specified, you have a sphere and there's arbitrarily high genius. You can choose an arbitrarily high genius surface to be a Hegart surface. So one given manifold, 3D manifold, can have many different Hegart splittings.
Okay, good. Thank you. So what, I mean, in this construction, then we can use any of the Hegart surfaces or
use
one Hegart surface?
Yeah, so in principle, we can use any of these Hegart surfaces, but what I am going to do is to treat these two different handle bodies differently. So I want, like this, what in the picture is handle body one, I allow handle body one to carry basically curvature defects. You know, so because this is the one skeleton of the triangulation, and usually what we have is that the one skeleton of the triangulation, in 3D at least, carries the curvature, and you want to impose that the loops around this handle body one, or around the one around the edges of the triangulation, are not contractible because you can have curvature on the edges. And so we can choose any Hegart splitting, but this Hegart splitting will determine our defect structure. So basically, that's why it's convenient to just start with the triangulation, which we want to represent, and then take the Hegart splitting associated to this triangulation. Okay?
Okay.
So that's actually, you know, that's what is said on the next slide. So we can indeed construct these Hegart diagrams from triangulations of the 3D manifold. And what we want to do is to keep these two different tandem bodies differently, or the two different set of cycles I described differently. We want to keep the cycles around the edges of the triangulation as non-trivial, as non-contractible. But we want to impose flatness for the two cycle, for the cycles which you can contract in Handel body 2. And as a fact, all these cycles which you can contract in the Handel body 2 are generated by the curves around the triangles of your triangulation. So if you want to impose all these cycles contractible in Handel body 2 are trivial, we just need to impose the flatness constraints for all these curves around the triangles. Okay. And this is basically the main idea, and I now proceed to the explicit construction. So the strategy is, I have to explain the Hilbert space operators and bases for a closed surface, and that will be actually for the solutions to 2 plus 1 gravity with cosmological constant. Unfortunately, that will be a bit detailed, but it's these are things which were developed mostly outside the quantum gravity community, but it's nice to also review it here. To some extent, this was described by Mark in his last ILQGS talk. We will apply it to a Hilbert surface constructed via triangulation, and then we will impose these constraints and see what kind of operators and bases we do get which are consistent with these constraints. So as a remark, in this talk, I will speak exclusively about the case for a fixed triangulation to really say you have a continuum quantum geometry realization. You would have to specify refinement maps, and you can indeed do that. And the operators I will describe are consistent with these kind of refinement maps. And they impose basically a flat vacuum, or basically this deformed flat vacuum, or the Krenietta TQFT. We will also see that we can have a state which is similar to the Ashtekar-Lewandowski type vacuum in being basically the spin network states where all spins are zero. And you could think of other refinements, but I'm not sure how consistent are the operators which I present. And we will indeed see why I'm saying that. Okay, so let's proceed to the Hilbert space for the 2 plus 1 dimensional Turev Viro TQFT. So as I mentioned, that was described by Mark some time ago, but actually the case we considered there was mostly a trivial topology, but with punctures. And here we will have non-trivial topology, but without punctures. And let me just describe you how you can basically construct a Hilbert space for the solutions of this theory. So you start with a kinematical Hilbert space, but it's a kinematical Hilbert space with gauge invariant states. And this is what you should know. So we take basically our Cauchy surface, and we consider graphs on this Cauchy surface, which are trivalent and labeled by SU2k spins. And in this case, these spins, which are allowed, they have a cutoff, which is given by one half of the level. And you also impose coupling rules on the nodes of the spin. And these are the usual SU2 coupling rules. You have one additional, again, cutoff, which says that the sum of all these three spins meeting at a node has to be smaller or equal than the level k. And so here you see the torus as an example with a trivalent graph labeled by three spins. And you can basically take all kinds of possible graphs and label by all kinds of different spins. Okay, so that's a kinematical Hilbert space. And as we know, what we want usually to do is to impose the diffeomorphism and Hamiltonian constraints to get to the physical Hilbert space. Or these deformed flatness constraints, basically. So here there's an ingenious trick. You do not solve for the flatness constraints explicitly, but you impose the flatness constraints as equivalence relations between these graph states. So that's the most important point to understand here. So these equivalence relations is something which you expect. So one, that strands can be isotopically deformed in your surface, and that defines equivalent states. Another is that strands with trivial spins can be omitted. So it just means that the zero strands with zero spin can be freely added or omitted. And the other two are the really dynamical ones. And as you can see, they impose something like invariance under changes of the dual triangle, of the triangulation dual to the graph. So we have the two Pachner moves. And here you have the F symbol appearing. The F symbol is just proportional to the usual 6J symbol. And so that imposes invariance under time evolution, these two moves. And we have the two Pachner moves and the 3-1 Pachner move. There's also these little V's appearing, which are just square roots of the quantum dimension associated to a certain spin representation. Okay, so basically we have now solved the theory. That's the ingenious trick of using these equivalence relations. But of course, you rather have transferred the problem of solving the Hamiltonian constraints to now finding a basis of independent states and finding operators which are consistent with these equivalence relations. And I will provide you now with this basis of independent states and these operators. But to do that, I need to introduce two concepts, and that's braiding and vacuum strands. And I proceed with the braiding. So here the idea is that strands can cross each other, and we can resolve these crossings into three valent graphs again, pieces of the graph. But it's important which strand overcrosses or undercrosses which strand. So all these graphs are supposed to be on a surface. And having this crossing, we can define the so-called S matrix. And we will see in a minute why it's called an S matrix. And that's defined as the evaluation of the Hopf link, which is depicted on the slide. And here, evaluation means that every planar graph, as for instance this Hopf link, you can use the equivalence relation to reduce such planar graphs to the empty graph. But you get a number in front of this empty graph, and this number is defined to be the evaluation of this planar graph. And I've depicted you this value of the S matrix on the slide because that will be basically determining all the eigenvalues of our operators, as you will see. And there's one important identity in which this S matrix appears. And this is if you have one strand encircling another strand, you can resolve this encircling to be with a S matrix. Again, all these graphs are supposed to be really on a surface. So if I say encircling, it's really just an over and under crossing of this one strand. Okay, so the second concept we will need is vacuum strands. These vacuum strands, you can imagine, are just like delta functions of your holonomy. So a vacuum strand is defined to be a linear combination of all possible strands with certain weights. And if you look at it and would close it, you recognize that it looks like the representation of the delta function in terms of characters. And indeed, these vacuum strands impose that you can deform any Wilson loop across any region which is enclosed by a vacuum strand. So this identity you can basically prove with these equivalence relations I have shown. And I will refer to this property as sliding property. So that just means you can move Wilson loops around a flat region, where this flat region is basically the one defined by the vacuum loop. Another important property which holds for SU2K is this killing property. A strand which is encircled by a vacuum loop is equivalent to basically a zero strand. Or has to be is either killed or has to be the zero strand. So these two concepts, braiding and vacuum strand, indeed appear in our definition for a basis for the Hilbert space. And as an example, I present the basis for the torus, which is the easiest or simplest example. This is basically a basis which is labeled by two spins, which you see here on the upper half of the slide. So we have a vacuum strand appearing, vacuum loop along the equator of the torus. And we have an undercrossing and an overcrossing Wilson loop labeled by these two spins across along the meridian of the torus. And indeed, we will see that, that this basis diagonalizes Wilson loops which go along the equator, but not Wilson loops which go along the meridian. So it imposes non-commutativity of the connection. And we actually will see that we have a quite unusual polarization here. So now we can ask, OK, I have this choice, but you should clearly be able to exchange meridian and equator. And indeed, you can do that. And that defines the so-called S transformation, which is really just the S transformation coming from the conformal group or from the mapping class transformation for the torus. And so you can change to the basis where equator and meridian are exchanged. And this basis transformation, the matrix elements are given by the S matrix. And that's where the name comes from. OK, so these states indeed define a basis. You can also define a basis for higher genus surfaces. And this is precisely also described in my paper. So these bases, you can choose, you can choose a so-called Pant decomposition of the surface. So a decomposition of the surface which you get by cutting the surface along curves, and the Pants refer to three punctured spheres. So you cut your surface so that you are just left with a bunch of three punctured spheres. What we need to know just now is that the basis states then just include a set of vacuum loops. Like in the torus, you just had one vacuum loop. There, in this case, we have more. We will have overcrossing graph, and we will have an undercrossing graph. So we'll always have a copy, basically an overcrossing and undercrossing copy of the same graph here, which will be labeled by SU2K spins. The last thing I need to discuss is are the operators. So usually we think of loop quantum gravity operators as fluxes and Wilson loops. But now we have to find operators which are consistent with the equivalence relations, which impose flatness. And so it turns out that the consistent operators are just given by under and overcrossing Wilson loops. And in fact, a parallel under and overcrossing, so it's two Wilson loops which are under and overcrossing and which go parallel, that gives you so-called Ripon operators. And these Ripon operators for classical groups indeed combine the holonomy and the integrated flux operators. So in 2 plus 1, it turns out that actually a parallel under and overcrossing loop where both spins are equal defines your flux operator. And a single loop, Wilson loop defines you the usual Wilson loop for the holonomy, which you can take as the Poincaré connection. So with the use of our tricks like braiding and vacuum loops and sliding property, we can also easily see how to diagonalize the Wilson loops. And in fact, the Wilson loops act parallel to vacuum loops in a chosen basis. I depicted how you can see that on the slide. So if you have a Wilson loop which goes parallel to a vacuum loop, you can use this vacuum loop to slide this Wilson loop across the vacuum loop. And what will happen is that this Wilson loop turns up to encircle just the strands of the graph, which define our basis. And if we have this case of one Wilson loop encircling a strand, we know that we can resolve that with the S matrix. So we see that the eigenvalues of our Wilson loops are given by the S matrix. So that's very nice. And so we can actually immediately diagonalize all these kind of Wilson loops and these combinations of holonomy and flux operators in our basis. We also see that here over and under crossing graphs and Wilson loops actually completely decouple. And that will be an important feature for if we go on and impose our constraints in the 3 plus 1 dimensional case. Okay, so that finishes actually my description of the 2 plus 1 dimensional theory. So that indeed describes... Yeah.
Can I ask a question about 2 plus 1
before we go to 3 plus 1? Yeah, so that was...
So, right, so, I mean, we... Previously, for 2 plus 1 theory, we knew how to solve it, right?
Sorry?
I mean, even with quantum group, we knew that what matters is homotopy classes for a given genus, and then we could take representations in either SU2 or SU2 quantum, and we could construct Dirac observables. So what is it that is, what was wrong with the previous way of looking at it, or why is what you're now doing better?
So this is first, this is a theory which comes from, which was not developed by me personally, but by some mathematician and in the quantum information computing community. So to my knowledge, the case with positive cosmological constant was actually not too nicely resolved. You can actually not treat this case with combinatorial quantization. That's maybe one fact. But we will also see here what we used is basically these equivalence relations, and they will play an important point in the 3 plus 1 dimensional theory. So
previously there was also equivalence relation, right? Because what mattered was homotopy classes of loops, and
I don't want to start with you an argument what is the better formulation. This is one formulation which came from basically originally from this proposal of string nets, and actually the motivation for this formulation was quite different and had more to do with condensed matter. And I use this formulation now to describe you the 3 plus 1 dimensional case.
Right. So therefore, I agree, but we just want to understand better because most people knew the older formulation. And so
gives you a nice description of really the complete Bayes states and operators for the positive cosmological constant case. Now we can discuss later on or after we can exchange and to which degree that has been done. I'm not an expert on 2 plus 1 dimensional theory. What I know is that in combinatorial quantization, you cannot treat this case.
So what you know is that combinatorial?
Combinatorial quantization, you know, which is mostly concerned with, it's about quantizing 2 plus 1 gravity. And you can treat with combinatorial quantization all cases of cosmological constant or signature, but you cannot treat Euclidean signature and positive cosmological constant.
Okay, thank you. Please go on.
Okay. So we now will just go and apply this 2 plus 1 dimensional series to the 3 plus 1 dimensional case. So to just summarize, we have seen that the consistent operators, which are consistent with the under and over with the equivalence relations, are under and over crossing Wilson loops. For these constructions, Brading relations play a very important role. But using our encoding of the 3D manifold into a Hilgert surface, we can use these Brading relations in our 3 plus 1 dimensional theory. And so to proceed, we will construct a basis for our Hilgert surface, impose the constraints, and find basically operators preserving these constraints. And again, I choose the simplest possible example, which doesn't come from a triangulation, but just describes you the case that you want to have a loop which can carry a curvature defect embedded in a 3 sphere. So it's a very degenerate triangulation if you want. And in this case, you know, what you would have to consider is the Hilgert surface, which you get by thickening this loop And so the Hegel surface will be given by the torus. And you get back your three sphere basically by gluing two toruses to each other. So we will consider the torus. And so you can imagine that the defect loop sits in this middle of the torus along the equator. So loops around the meridian would go around this defect loop and would not be contractible. But what we want to impose is that the loops around the equator are contractible in this three sphere. So the flatness constraint will be given by a vacuum loop, which I choose here to be the overcrossing vacuum loop along the equator. So I just have taken the basis states I just discussed and have drawn this red vacuum loop around the equator. And what this vacuum loop does is basically just too simple to suppress the overcrossing graph copy. So we are just left with the undercrossing graph copy, which in this case is just one Wilson loop. And how this happens, you see in the lower picture. Basically, what you use is, again, the sliding property. And you slide the red vacuum loop over the black one. And then you get one red vacuum loop encircling the overcrossing strand. And then you use the killing property I had to see that this overcrossing spin label has to be zero, and you are just left with the undercrossing spin. So basically, we see we are just left with the undercrossing graph copy. And we describe this in one choice of basis. And now we can take this solution we got, so the just having this undercrossing loop, and apply an S transformation and get basically the same set of solutions, but described in a different basis. And what happens there is that we will now have loops along the equator, which are labeled by a spin I. But in this case, we will have also an overcrossing vacuum loop, which clearly imposes, again, the flatness constraint. So basically, we have now the same solutions expressed in two different bases. One is actually the spin network basis, because we have a graph, like the loop, which is dual to the defect loop. So it's dual to the triangulation. And this labeled by this just one loop is labeled by spin J. As we will see, it diagonalizes the Wilson loops around the equator. And I will argue that it measures the area spanned by this curvature defect. And the other basis, we have this Wilson loop, the strand which goes around along the curvature defect. So it's based on the one skeleton of the triangulation. And we will see that it diagonalizes Wilson loops around the meridian. So Wilson loops which are supposed to measure the curvature. And they will indeed measure the curvature defect. Okay, and actually, so what we see is that this S transformation indeed acts as a quantum group Fourier transform. So it transforms between the spin network basis and the dual curvature basis. So you can do the same for general 3D triangulations, and the details are described in my paper. So for instance, if you want to construct a generalized spin network basis, then you take the Hegart surface, and now there's a mistake on the slide, from the thickening of the dual graph to the triangulation, so not the one skeleton of the triangulation, but the dual graph. And basically now you see easily, as in the torus case, that these flatness constraints just suppress the overcrossing graph copy. And so you're just left with the undercrossing graph copy. And this undercrossing graph copy will just coincide with your dual graph to the triangulation. So it gives you just a generalization of the spin network basis. But in this Hegart surface description, we will have basically this one graph copy, which is just a dual graph. And we just have these labels. But we will also have these vacuum loops, basically, which are transversal to these graphs. And these are sometimes important for considerations. OK, so this gives you the spin network basis. There's also a curvature basis, and again, you can choose a Pant decomposition, which is basically the other extreme case, which is adjusted to the one skeleton of the triangulation. And what after imposing the flatness constraints, you will get basically the curvature basis. So what you will have is an undercrossing graph copy, which goes along the triangulation, the one skeleton of the triangulation itself. So here I depicted the example of a tetrahedron. You will have the vacuum loops, which come from the original basis going around the edges of this triangulation. You will also have something like an overcrossing graph, but this overcrossing graph will be just given by vacuum loops going around the triangles of your tetrahedron. And so for most considerations, these overcrossing graphs, so the overcrossing vacuum loops will not show up. With this curvature basis at hand, we can easily define the vacuum state, where you would basically assign just to all edges trivial spins. And that will be the state where basically all curvature or excess curvature is set to zero. And here I describe only the sphere, but this gives you a unique ground state for all topologies. And indeed, the Krein-Jetta invariant is a trivial invariant, which means it does not distinguish between different topologies and 4D, and that's the reason why you get actually a unique kind of ground state. So the last thing is to consider operators for the 3 plus 1 dimensional theory. And here we basically take the operators which were first consistent with equivalence relations in our 2 plus 1 dimensional theory. But now we have also to take operators which respect the flatness constraints. And the flatness constraints we have seen basically suppress the overcrossing graph copy. So what we just left with are undercrossing Wilson loops. But we have two different kinds of Wilson loops. I mean, we have actually much more Wilson loops you can think of. But there's in particular two classes. There are Wilson loops around the edges of the triangulation. And these, you know, would measure the curvature or the excess curvature on the edges of the triangulation. So this excess curvature, I mean, an excess to the homogeneous curvature, which is anyway in this vacuum state. So these Wilson loops are indeed diagonalized by the curvature basis and would measure the curvature. Then we have also Wilson loop around triangles, these undercrossing Wilson loops. And these are diagonalized by the spin network basis. And so these measure the area of triangles. And basically, I give three reasons why they measure the area of the triangles. The first one is that in this paper with Clément Delcamp, we considered actually the classical group case. And in this case, you can consider the rhythm operators of your 2 plus 1 dimensional theory, and you can show explicitly that the rhythm operators which preserve the constraints, the flatness constraints, which you have around the triangles, do indeed map to the integrated flux operators of the 3 plus 1 dimensional theory. And the Wilson loops, the rhythm operators around the edges, do indeed map to holonomy operators. So that's very nicely described in this paper. And you can also, in this paper, we also considered more involved cases of these rhythm operators, which go around two triangles and so on. So in this classical case, indeed, kind of rhythm operators around triangles give you integrated fluxes. The second reason comes from Hall-Haggard in France. And so where they also have basically that fluxes and holonomies are both imposed by Wilson loops, and where the area are measured also by Wilson loops around triangles. And the third reason is that indeed the spectra which we get do match the classical limit, as you can basically see from the expression I wrote here for the normalized K-Wilson loop. You can extract the J plus 1 spectrum for the squared area. And indeed, we basically have we are dealing here with the spin network basis, which diagonalizes Wilson loops around the triangles. Okay. So we can nicely, you know, quantize areas and curvatures, and we have basically the spectrum of both these operators. And as you can see, it's discrete because it would be labeled by these quantum spins, and it's also bounded because of all the signs which appear. And it coincides for this exponentiated area operator and for the curvature operator. And thus, we have a self-dual quantum geometry. And so what it means is that actually that we started from, in principle, a phase space, which is SU2 cross SU2, just that there is no phase space associated to SU2 cross SU2. And you have to work with quasi-Poisson-Li structures on the space. So actually, the classical theory is kind of very involved to describe. And to some degree, this quantum theory is a bit simpler than the classical theory. So I'm almost at the end of my talk. On this slide, I just show you some nice pictures. So you can also consider examples with even more self-duality. If you consider the triangulation of the three sphere by a four simplex, then what is dual to a four simplex in 3D would be again the four simplex. So you, in both cases, you have the same graph topology for this curvature and the spin network basis, and it would be labeled by 15 spins in both things. So you have the curvature basis, and which I depicted here, and then there's dual to that also the spin network basis for the four simplex. And yeah, that gives you a 3D triangulation, where in contrast to just having the Kreh-Nyerta vacuum, you can have actually curvature concentrated on the edges of this four simplex. Another example, which I just mentioned here, is the three torus, where you can go to a hypercubical cubical lattice, and two dual to that would be again a dual lattice. And this is just to say that you don't need to take a triangulation. You can easily take any lattice to construct your Hilbert surface. Okay. So actually, I come to the conclusions of my talk. So this uses basically very nicely two QFTs. And in my view, it enforces like one of the most important advantages of loop quantum gravity and spin foams, and that's the relation to TQFT. And that, you know, were developments which started a long time ago by Lee Smolin, by Louis Crane, and by John Barrett. And to some degree, in canonical loop quantum gravity, we are not there for a long time, but now we do have quantum geometry realizations which are really based on these TQFTs and use a lot of these TQFTs tools. Why do I see that as an advantage? Because this relation can be crucial for the continuum limit, because the TQFTs usually encode a more interesting geometric phase. So one can argue whether in 3+1, to some extent, it already describes a flat geometry or homogeneously curved geometries. And so it's more than what other approaches have. So that's I think, for me, the most important reason. And the other is the exchange of elegant techniques between canonical quantum gravity and TQFTs, which, especially on the TQFT side, is also gaining much momentum right now for the four-dimensional theory. So that's my comment on the dynamics. There's, of course, now many things you can do dynamically. And for instance, spin foam amplitudes based on a related framework have been constructed in this work by Hal Haggard, Moshin Han, Wojtek Kaminski, and Aldo Riello. Here, this new vacua, these different vacua, can actually be used as starting points for different approximation schemes for the dynamics. And the point is that different vacua give you different truncations, and so might be suited for different scenarios, or just, you know, in a better way for certain things you want to achieve. So then I come to this point, which I already mentioned in the beginning. That's basically that this quantum geometry offers many advantages because it's finite, which really allows you to coarse grain numerically. And we now have also a much broader set of gauge invariant bases, because we have the spin network basis, we have the curvature basis, which in this case is just discrete and labeled by quantum group spins. But we have also many different bases which you can use to coarse grain, and where you already can implement a coarse graining scheme. So we have now again a new quantum geometry realization, and of course this opens the question: how many quantum geometry realizations are out there, and how do predictions depend on this choice of representation? So there are many open questions and directions to go. I mean, one is, as I mentioned, you know, more quantum geometries. Where maybe the most interesting point is that in this work by John Barrett and Manuel Behrens, they do construct non-trivial four-dimensional invariants, and we can actually also impose that in our case. And what you would have to do is to change or actually weaken these flatness constraints for the triangles. And I believe that is related to torsion, and so that is another line of investigation where we can understand also better the relationship with torsion in our theory. There is also a lot to do in understanding the current model. One big subject are boundaries, which are in particular interesting in terms of surface degrees of freedom. And another interesting and open thing is basically to reconstruct the geometric interpretation in addition to the work which Hull and Franz have been done. There's interesting work of Etterat and his student Christoph Charles, which are concerned with, you know, deformed phase spaces. And the second question is to include the Barbero-Emisi parameter. And as I mentioned, to study all the different bases you can have. So that finishes my talk. And on this last slide, I've also given a bunch of references. A bunch of references, and also references which you might not know so well, and which come from outside the community, which were important for this work. So thank you.
Questions?
Okay, question.
Yeah.
So just building on your last remarks, if you include, well, first of all, let me make a general remark that this really is realizing in great detail the vision that Lewis Crane had, and we had, and John and John had way back a long time ago, and it's beautiful to see develop. So in particular, you just mentioned the outlook with putting on boundaries.
Uh-huh.
Is there a chance to revisit the isolated horizon structure and story and understand in more detail how the entropy and temperature and so forth of black holes would be influenced by the positive cosmological constant?
Indeed, there is a chance to do that. As you know, there's very interesting work by Hanno Salmann, where in some sense he uses one construction where you use one kind of vacuum in the parallel direction to the in the transversal direction to the horizon, and some kind of BF vacuum parallel to the horizon. So that's to impose these isolated horizon conditions. I guess if you, you know, it would be even nicer to do that with a quantum group structure, or to see really what happens if you really use this new vacuum and do the result change or not. So many features are very similar because now you really have the spin network basis also in this case. That's different from the SU2 case where we considered the BF vacuum, but the spin network basis was only a generalized basis, which was not defining properly normalized states. So here we indeed have the spin network basis. So another advantage is that you can basically consider, I mean, it could lead to exactly the same counting problem as before, but now with a quantum group, and maybe that has been done because I'm not aware of all things which have been done, but you can also consider basically things which start from the curvature basis.
So we're at large K, which is small cosmological constant, but still at large K, there are corrections. Mm-hmm. To the story on the isolated horizon, and it's uh-huh. partly been worked out, but there's a lot left to do.
Uh-huh.
And the last remark, which I can't resist, is the possibility of seeing in the quantum group structure with the positive cosmological constant the idea of modifications of the classical and Newtonian limit arising.
The classical what?
The classical and the Newtonian limit may be modified by terms in the cosmological constant.
As a modified Newtonian limit. Yeah. I mean, so nicely, I think it probably allows to generalize work which has been done on non-commutative. Like maybe it's not so much related, but on non-commutative spaces in 2+1 by Laurent and et al. To 3+1, because here we do have two non-commutative spaces, so the fluxes do not commute, the holonomies do not commute, because both spaces are now compact. So of course from the perspective of deformed Lorentz groups, there could be very interesting theory behind that. So I hope one can say something on this kinematical level, because I usually think one needs a bit of dynamics to do that. But kinematically, there are also interesting directions to think maybe about deformed symmetry algebras. And I think in particular, there was, there's this recent work of Daniele Pranzetti and Kowalski-Glickman, which argued that in 2+1 you can get the deformed Poincaré algebra from the quantum group structure, if I'm not too. So that would be interesting to repeat in 3+1, of course.
Okay, thank you.
And it kind of could lead to an effect which comes from the cosmological constant, really. On large scales.
Bianca, can I ask a question?
Yeah.
So a couple of questions. I mean, the first is continuing along the lines that Lee was just saying. In the case of these isolated horizons, the very first calculations that was done with John Baez and Krasina, there also we noticed that in fact the spectrum of the curvature operator coincided. I mean, there was an isolated horizon boundary condition and. Uh-huh. That could be implemented quantum mechanically only if two operators, which are quite distinct, one in the bulk Hilbert space, one in the surface Hilbert space, the spectra completely coincided. I mean, on a general level, it seems to me that what you're saying here is very similar. I mean, the reason why, you had these two-handed bodies, and if I look at that, you had this this area and the curvature, the curvature was contained in the holonomy, and the area was contained in the basically the piercing of the surface element by the edge, and so it looks very similar. So my question is really twofold. So one is, what is the relation? And in particular, I'm a little bit confused because then would you be saying that there is entropy associated with any surface, any two surface, because there it was quantum horizon boundary condition was important. Here it seems to me that you are getting something which has nothing to do with quantum horizon, just any old surface. So that's it. So the more general question is, what is in general terms a relation between the two things? And the second question is about, would you be led to say that there is entropy associated with every surface?
So let me first go to the same spectra. So you could assume that you get same spectra if you, for curvature and area operator, if you indeed impose the homogeneous curvature geometry, which you probably did in the isolated horizon case, because then in this case, if you consider the spin connection, the curvature of the spin connection would indeed measure the area of your surface because you have homogeneous curvature. I see that, but I believe that's not exactly the same reason why you get the same spectra here. So here the curvature measures really the curvature defects you have and not the homogeneous curvature. And I believe that this reason that you have the same spectra is going back to something which is known as polar duality and which comes from the fact that to a given simplex, you can construct a dual simplex. And in the case of homogeneously positive curvature, the sizes of these, or the range of sizes of these two simplices is the same. So both simplices have compact lengths and so on. So it's interesting what you say. The two reasons why you get the same spectra might be different. So the second question is you are saying something about do I want to associate entropy to any two surface? Actually, I'm the one which indeed I'm puzzled because many people seem to do that actually. So I think even many people do that in loop quantum gravity. So here, you can take this result about getting the spin network basis that this picture is not too different from the usual spin network picture. So I mean, I don't think that I do want to impose or define an entropy for any two surface. You can probably do that, but it's more a question about how special are the isolated horizon conditions, maybe. So here, what we do have is a homogeneously curved vacuum state. It's related to the isolated horizon condition, which you, however, only impose for the surface. But we can have also curvature defects. So for sure, we can also violate this isolated horizon condition if you want to, if you put curvature defects. So I think one still has to go through this question, how to impose this isolated horizon condition in this framework. And then a second question is how specifying or how general are these isolated horizon conditions, right? Which is a point which Laurent sometimes criticizes.
So you're saying basically, maybe it is true that every surface has an entropy and maybe it is not true. Is that what you're saying?
I mean, I just said, I have seen very often that people do that all the time to associate entropies to two surfaces. But if you ask that, is the isolated horizon condition satisfied always in our case? I say no. I mean, maybe what you seem to say is maybe wondering whether we always satisfy the isolated horizon condition on every surface.
No, you don't have that. But okay, let me just ask a second question,
okay,
which is really that one of the things that you emphasized was that this analysis also brings to this topological field theory methods to the canonical picture.
Uh-huh.
That's what. And so the question is, in what ways do you see that where this infinitely many ambiguities in the Hamiltonian constraint and so on in the canonical picture. And, you know, there's ongoing work on many interesting directions by Alok and Madhavan and other people in the canonical picture. So in what sense, in what ways do you feel that this way of looking at 3 plus 1 coming from 2 plus 1 simplifies or does not simplify the task of removing the ambiguities in the Hamiltonian constraint?
Yeah, I haven't thought in details about this about the specific question. So there's a larger question here, which is, you know, which kind of vacuum state or which kind of framework is better or is nicely suited for imposing the dynamics. In my view, it's basically here you have a picture where you have a homogeneous curvature, which you can say to some extent is a solution of classical gravity, and you have curvature defects, and to some extent, you know, it's a question, is this picture kind of stable under the dynamics? You know, can you approximate GR well as a theory which where you approximate your dynamics with piecewise homogeneously curved building blocks with curvature defects? I think many people or some people would indeed say it might work better or you have less work to do than approximating a classical GR by starting from a totally degenerate theory. So at least this framework seems to be nicely suited for, you know, getting larger scale states or states which describe larger scale geometries. So the question is, can you resolve all kinds of ambiguities? This, I believe, I mean, in my personal opinion is that to this end, you have to do coarse graining and so on. So on top of that, you would have to impose coarse graining work to get rid of the discretization scale, which is induced by using a triangulation. Then indeed, it's a question, I believe also that this could be a starting point which is more advantageous because you have these finiteness properties, for instance, and which makes it easier to consider, for instance, numerical coarse graining, or you have a vacuum state which, you know, is already describes a nice geometry and a nice phase. So in the end, the question is, I mean, a hopeful dream is, can we really approximate GR as a PQFT with defects? There's now a number of approaches which try to do that. You know, I'm not giving you a definite answer whether this is the case or not. It's one hope which many people have. And in this case, I believe this could be really a big advantage to start with this framework.
Now, let me sharpen the question, because there are many ideas that are coming together. One is using a different representation and so on. But I think the specific thing that I thought was new in the seminar was this idea about going from 2 plus 1 to 3 plus 1.
To 3 plus 1, yeah. How is
it? So my question was not about, so these other ideas that you mentioned about, you know, Hamiltonian constraint, I mean, the dynamics may be simpler and so on and so forth. That is just, that's a separate issue. The question was, I was really focusing on this going from to 3 plus 1 from 2 plus 1 and this way of looking at kinematics, whether this specifically you think has any elements built into it which would remove the ambiguities. Or it seems to me that you're saying that at this stage you don't see it, but
I have not talked about this. You know, there was a question which ambiguities you want to resolve. I mean, an idea would be, can you use the 2 plus 1 dimensional dynamics to say something about 3 plus 1? Basically, here we already use the 2 plus 1 dimensional dynamics a lot because that was in the equivalence relation, which we actually also use now in 3 plus 1. But how that helps to really resolve possible ambiguities for the Hamiltonian constraints, which in this framework you would still need to construct. and which would have kind of, you know, a priori similar problems like in the Ashtika-Lewandowski case. I don't know. What I do believe, what is worked out in the classical case is that it allows for a nicer geometric interpretation for the action of the Hamiltonian constraint, which is nearer to the Ricci case. So that's one statement, but it has more to do with the new vacuum in general. So the nicer geometric interpretation is now that now the constraints are really supposed to move the defects, the curvature defects. And that's also what happens in the Ricci case.
Just to follow up very quickly, at a very heuristic level, the use of the topological quantum field theory state is the vacuum with the cosmological constant suggests that you're using an ordering of the Hamiltonian constraint where the self-dual projection operator, the B is proportional to lambda E, is moved to the right.
So what I should have mentioned is that is also Lee's point that I think this brings us might bring us very near to a realization of the Kodama state, which might be a solution to the Hamiltonian constraints, which with a specific ordering. So that's maybe one.
But made precise. That's very heuristic. Some precise version of that.
Yeah. So that's one ambiguity it could help to resolve.
Bianca, I have two questions. One is, you mentioned this idea of a polar duality, that this duality between the two bases might correspond to. I'm wondering how explicit that is. So, for example, in the talk you showed us that you know a generalized Fourier transform between these two bases. Is there a correspondence between that and the polar transform?
So let me think about the, I need to remember what the polar duality again is. There you take a four simplex and you construct a so-called dual four simplex, which comes, it's basically the dual four simplex. I think in this case, there is probably a relation that indeed the graphs describe these two different simplices in the simplex case.
Okay, my other question is, after the conclusions of the talk, in the remaining slides, you mentioned, for example, connections to condensed matter and this Walker-Wang Hamiltonian.
Okay, yeah, that's actually on the next slide after the thank you slide, yeah.
I'm just curious about whether there are tools from condensed matter that this is going to help us to import, and whether you see interesting connections with these topological phases.
So the Walker-Wang model, I mean, what I do believe is actually that this work provides a much better definition of the Walker-Wang model, because the Walker-Wang model is defined more ad hoc. So you would actually just take the, I think it's basically the spin network basis, but without these vacuum loops. And some arguments which I encountered in the literature are actually a bit inconsistent. Because you don't explicitly use basically basically all the vacuum loop structure you have, and so this actually provides a more consistent definition of this model, which originally has actually also only be defined for a cubical lattice. So here we can do it for any triangulation, and we can completely simplify arguments which are found in the literature. So actually, that's, you know, I have to say I imported for the 2+1 theory. We imported actually things from the condensed matter community to loop quantum gravity community or to us. But here, I think it's really where we did something new, which can help them. So what they did also consider are surface anions, and this is a subject which also becomes quite popular in our community now. The question of boundaries and degrees of freedom associated to boundaries. Indeed, we can take what is known in the condensed matter community. There's basically one work where this is discussed, which is cited there by Kaiserling et al. I also believe that these techniques I discussed can be probably used to make it even a bit nicer. And for instance, Hegart splitting can be indeed generalized to 3D manifold with boundaries, and this gives so-called compression bodies. But I think there's also many other options to think about boundaries. Well, that's, there is indeed a very open question in general in TQFT and category theory, namely what labels all possible defects for 4D TQFT. That is a long-standing open question, which we might get nearer, but I don't know whether we will finally answer it. So technically, it's a question, what is a totally extended four-dimensional TQFT? So the main point is that the investigation of four-dimensional topological faces has actually just very recently started. And I think we can actually now export techniques to this theory.
Thank you.
Are there more questions or comments?
Yeah, there's a question here.
So, apart from the exchange of momentum and position degrees of freedom, is there any other interpretation in terms of probably exchange of skills?
So Prince is asking whether the self-duality, apart from exchanging momentum and configuration, also exchanges somehow scales. And it's a good question, and I have to think about it. So indeed, usually what happens in the Ising model, if you have these kind of dualities, which are, however, between partition functions, you change the coupling constant to 1 over the coupling constant of a different theory. So here, you would have to put in all the constants and interpretations you have to see whether lambda is exchanged with 1 over lambda, which is a curvature scale, and the other is more length scale or something. Okay.
More questions? If not, let us thank the speaker.
Thank you.